The horrible conclusion, which had been gradually intruding itself upon my confused and reluctant mind, was now an awful certainty. I was lost, completely, hopelessly lost, in the vast and labyrinthine recesses of the Mammoth Cave. Turn as I might, in no direction could my straining vision seize on any object capable of serving as a guidepost to set me on the outward path. That never more should I behold the blessed light of day, or scan the pleasant hills and dales of the beautiful world outside, my reason could no longer entertain the slightest unbelief. Hope had departed. Yet, indoctrinated as I was by a life of philosophical study, I derived no small measure of satisfaction from my unimpassioned demeanor, for although I had frequently read of the wild frenzies into which were thrown the victims of similar situations, I experienced none of these, but stood quiet as soon as I clearly realized the loss of my bearings. Nor did the thought that I had probably wandered beyond the utmost limits of an ordinary search cause me to abandon my composure, even for a moment. If I must die, I reflected, then was this terrible yet majestic cavern as welcome a sepulcher as that which any churchyard might afford, a conception which carried with it more of tranquility than of despair. Starving would prove my ultimate fate, of this I was certain. Some, I knew, had gone mad under circumstances such as these, but I felt that this end would not be mine. My disaster was the result of no fault save my own, since unknown to the guide I had separated myself from the regular party of sightseers, and wandering for over an hour in forbidden avenues of the cave, had found myself unable to retrace the devious windings which I had pursued since forsaking my companions. Already my torch had begun to expire. Soon I would be enveloped by the total and almost palpable blackness of the bowels of the earth. As I stood in the waning, unsteady light, I idly wondered over the exact circumstances of my coming end. I remembered the accounts which I had heard of the colony of consumptives, who, taking their residence in this gigantic grotto to find health from the apparently salubrious air of the underground world, with its steady uniform temperature, pure air, and peaceful quiet, had found instead death in strange and ghastly form. I had seen the sad remains of their ill-made cottages as I passed them by with the party, and had wondered what unnatural influence a long sojourn in this immense and silent cavern would exert upon one as healthy and vigorous as I. Now, I grimly told myself, my opportunity for settling this point had arrived, provided that want of food should not bring me too speedy a departure from this life. As the last fitful rays of my torch faded into obscurity, I resolved to leave no stone unturned, no possible means of escape neglected. So, summoning all the powers possessed by my lungs, I set up a series of loud shoutings in the vain hope of attracting the attention of the guide by my clamor. Yet as I called, I believed in my heart that my cries were to no purpose, and that my voice, magnified and reflected by the numberless ramparts of the black maze about me, fell upon no ears save my own. All at once, however, my attention was fixed with a start as I fancied that I heard the sound of soft approaching steps on the rocky floor of the cavern. Was my deliverance about to be accomplished so soon? Had then all my horrible apprehensions been for naught? And was the guide, having marked my unwarranted absence from the party, following my course and seeking me out in this limestone labyrinth? While these joyful queries arose in my brain, I was on the point of renewing my cries, in order that my discovery might come the sooner, when in an instant my delight was turned to horror as I listened, for my ever-acute ear, now sharpened in even greater degree by the complete silence of the cave, bore to my benumbed understanding the unexpected and dreadful knowledge that these footfalls were not like those of any mortal man. In the unearthly stillness of this subterranean region, the tread of the booted guide would have sounded like a series of sharp and incisive blows. These impacts were soft and stealthy, as of the paws of some feline. Besides, when I listened carefully, I seemed to trace the falls of 4 instead of 2 feet. I was now convinced that I had, by my own cries, aroused and attracted some wild beast, perhaps a mountain lion, which had accidentally strayed within the cave. Perhaps, I considered, the Almighty had chosen for me a swifter and more merciful death than that of hunger. Yet the instinct of self-preservation, never wholly dormant, was stirred in my breast, and though escape from the oncoming peril might but spare me for a sterner and more lingering end, I determined nevertheless to part with my life at as high a price as I could command. Strange as it may seem, my mind conceived of no intent upon the part of the visitor, save that of hostility. Accordingly, I became very quiet, in the hope that the unknown beast would, in the absence of a guiding sound, lose its direction, as had I, and thus pass me by. But this hope was not destined for realization, for the strange footfall steadily advanced, the animal evidently having obtained my scent, which in an atmosphere so absolutely free from all distracting influences as is that of the cave, could doubtless be followed at great distance. Seeing, therefore, that I must be armed for defense against an uncanny and unseen attack in the dark, I groped about me the largest of the fragments of rock, which were strewn upon all parts of the floor of the cavern in the vicinity, and grasping one in each hand for immediate use, awaited with resignation the inevitable result. Meanwhile, the hideous pattering of the paws drew near. Certainly, the conduct of the creature was exceedingly strange. Most of the time, the tread seemed to be that of a quadruped, walking with a singular lack of unison betwixt hind and 4 feet. Yet at brief and infrequent intervals, I fancied that but 2 feet were engaged in the process of locomotion. I wondered what species of animal was to confront me. It must, I thought, be some unfortunate beast who had paid for its curiosity to investigate one of the entrances of the fearful grotto with a lifelong confinement in its interminable recesses. It doubtless obtained as food the eyeless fish, bats, and rats of the cave, as well as some of the ordinary fish that are wafted in at every freshet of Green River, which communicates in some occult manner with the waters of the cave. I occupied my terrible vigil with grotesque conjectures of what alteration cave life might have wrought in the physical structure of the beast, remembering the awful appearances ascribed by local tradition to the consumptives who had died after long residence in the cave. Then I remembered with a start that even should I succeed in felling my antagonist, I should never behold its form, as my torch had long since been extinct, and I was entirely unprovided with matches. The tension on my brain now became frightful. My disordered fancy conjured up hideous and fearsome shapes from the sinister darkness that surrounded me, and that actually seemed to press upon my body. Nearer, nearer, the dreadful footfalls approached. It seemed that I must give vent to a piercing scream, yet had I been sufficiently irresolute to attempt such a thing, my voice could scarce have responded. I was petrified, rooted to the spot. I doubted if my right arm would allow me to hurl its missile at the oncoming thing when the crucial moment should arrive. Now the steady pat-pat of the steps was close at hand, now very close. I could hear the labored breathing of the animal, and terror-struck as I was, I realized that it must have come from a considerable distance and was correspondingly fatigued. Suddenly the spell broke. My right hand, guided by my ever-trustworthy sense of hearing, threw with full force the sharp-angled bit of limestone which it contained toward that point in the darkness from which emanated the breathing and pattering, and wonderful to relate, it nearly reached its goal. For I heard the thing jump, landing at a distance away, where it seemed to pause. Having readjusted my aim, I discharged my second missile, this time most effectively, for with a flood of joy I listened as the creature fell in what sounded like a complete collapse, and evidently remained prone and unmoving. Almost overpowered by the great relief which rushed over me, I reeled back against the wall. The breathing continued, in heavy, gasping inhalations and expirations, whence I realized that I had no more than wounded the creature. And now all desire to examine the thing ceased. At last, something allied to groundless, superstitious fear had entered my brain, and I did not approach the body, nor did I continue to cast stones at it in order to complete the extinction of its life. Instead, I ran at full speed in what was, as nearly as I could estimate in my frenzied condition, the direction from which I had come. Suddenly I heard a sound, or rather, a regular succession of sounds. In another instant they had resolved themselves into a series of sharp metallic clicks. This time there was no doubt. It was the guide. And then I shouted, yelled, screamed, even shrieked with joy, as I beheld in the vaulted arches above the faint and glimmering effulgence which I knew to be the reflected light of an approaching torch. I ran to meet the flare, and before I could completely understand what had occurred, was lying upon the ground at the feet of the guide, embracing his boots and gibbering, despite my boasted reserve, in a most meaningless and idiotic manner, pouring out my terrible story, and at the same time overwhelming my auditor with protestations of gratitude. At length I awoke to something like my normal consciousness. The guide had noted my absence upon the arrival of the party at the entrance of the cave, and had, from his own intuitive sense of direction, proceeded to make a thorough canvas of by passages just ahead of where he had last spoken to me, locating my whereabouts after a quest of about 4 hours. By the time he had related this to me, I, emboldened by his torch and his company, began to reflect upon the strange beast which I had wounded but a short distance back in the darkness, and suggested that we ascertain, by the flashlight's aid, what manner of creature was my victim. Accordingly, I retraced my steps, this time with a courage born of companionship, to the scene of my terrible experience. Soon we descried a white object upon the floor, an object whiter even than the gleaming limestone itself. Cautiously advancing, we gave vent to a simultaneous ejaculation of wonderment, for of all the unnatural monsters either of us had in our lifetimes beheld, this was in surpassing degree the strangest. It appeared to be an anthropoid ape of large proportions, escaped perhaps from some itinerant menagerie. Its hair was snow-white, a thing due, no doubt, to the bleaching action of a long existence within the inky confines of the cave, but it was also surprisingly thin, being indeed largely absent save on the head, where it was of such length and abundance that it fell over the shoulders in considerable profusion. The face was turned away from us, as the creature lay almost directly upon it. The inclination of the limbs was very singular, explaining, however, the alternation in their use which I had before noted, whereby the beast used sometimes all four, and on other occasions but two, for its progress. From the tips of the fingers or toes, long rat-like claws extended. The hands or feet were not prehensile, a fact that I ascribed to that long residence in the cave, which, as I before mentioned, seemed evident from the all-pervading and almost unearthly whiteness so characteristic of the whole anatomy. No tail seemed to be present. The respiration had now grown very feeble, and the guide had drawn his pistol with the evident intent of dispatching the creature, when a sudden sound emitted by the latter caused the weapon to fall unused. The sound was of a nature difficult to describe. It was not like the normal note of any known species of simian, and I wonder if this unnatural quality were not the result of a long-continued and complete silence, broken by the sensations produced by the advent of the light, a thing which the beast could not have seen since its first entrance into the cave. The sound, which I might feebly attempt to classify as a kind of deep-toned chattering, was faintly continued. All at once a fleeting spasm of energy seemed to pass through the frame of the beast. The paws went through a convulsive motion, and the limbs contracted. With a jerk, the white body rolled over so that its face was turned in our direction. For a moment I was so struck with horror at the eyes thus revealed that I noted nothing else. They were black, those eyes, deep jetty black, in hideous contrast to the snow-white hair and flesh. Like those of other cave denizens, they were deeply sunken in their orbits and were entirely destitute of iris. As I looked more closely, I saw that they were set in a face less prognathous than that of the average ape, and infinitely less hairy. The nose was quite distinct. As we gazed upon the uncanny sight presented to our vision, the thick lips opened, and several sounds issued from them, after which the thing relaxed in death. The guide clutched my coat sleeve and trembled so violently that the light shook fitfully, casting weird moving shadows on the walls. I made no motion, but stood rigidly still, my horrified eyes fixed upon the floor ahead. The fear left, and wonder, awe, compassion, and reverence succeeded in its place, for the sounds uttered by the stricken figure that lay stretched out on the limestone had told us the awesome truth. The creature I had killed, the strange beast of the unfathomed cave, was, or had at one time, been a man. I have never heard an even approximately adequate explanation of the horror at Martin's Beach. Despite the large number of witnesses, no two accounts agree, and the testimony taken by local authorities contains the most amazing discrepancies. Perhaps this haziness is natural in view of the unheard-of character of the horror itself, the almost paralytic terror of all who saw it, and the efforts made by the fashionable Wavecrest Inn to hush it up after the publicity created by Professor Ahon's article, "Our Hypnotic Powers Confined to Recognized Humanity." Against all these obstacles, I am striving to present a coherent version, for I beheld the hideous occurrence, and believe it should be known in view of the appalling possibilities it suggests. Martin's Beach is once more popular as a watering place, but I shudder when I think of it. Indeed, I cannot look at the ocean at all now without shuddering. Fate is not always without a sense of drama and climax, hence the terrible happening of August 8, 1922. Swiftly followed a period of minor and agreeably wonder-fraught excitement at Martin's Beach. On May 17th, the crew of the fishing smack Alma of Gloucester, under Captain James P. Orne, killed, after a battle of nearly 40 hours, a marine monster whose size and aspect produced the greatest possible stir in scientific circles and caused certain Boston naturalists to take every precaution for its taxidermic preservation. The object was some 50 feet in length, of roughly cylindrical shape, and about 10 feet in diameter. It was unmistakably a gilled fish in its major affiliations, but with certain curious modifications, such as rudimentary forelegs and six-toed feet in place of pectoral fins, which prompted the widest speculation. Its extraordinary mouth, its thick and scaly hide, and its single deep-set eye were wonders scarcely less remarkable than its colossal dimensions. And when the naturalist pronounced it an infant organism, which could not have been hatched more than a few days, public interest mounted to extraordinary heights. Captain Orne, with typical Yankee shrewdness, obtained a vessel large enough to hold the object in its hull and arranged for the exhibition of his prize. With judicious carpentry, he prepared what amounted to an excellent marine museum, and sailing south to the wealthy resort district of Martin's Beach, anchored at the hotel wharf and reaped a harvest of admission fees. The intrinsic marvelousness of the object and the importance which it clearly bore in the minds of many scientific visitors from near and far combined to make it the season's sensation. That it was absolutely unique, unique to a scientifically revolutionary degree, was well understood. The naturalists had shown plainly that it radically differed from the similarly immense fish caught off the Florida coast, that while it was obviously an inhabitant of almost incredible depths, perhaps thousands of feet, its brain and principal organs indicated a development startlingly vast and out of all proportion to anything hitherto associated with the fish tribe. On the morning of July 20th, the sensation was increased by the loss of the vessel and its strange treasure. In the storm of the preceding night, it had broken from its moorings and vanished forever from the sight of man, carrying with it the guard who had slept aboard despite the threatening weather. Captain Orne, backed by extensive scientific interests and aided by large members of fishing boats from Gloucester, made a thorough and exhaustive searching cruise, but with no result other than the prompting of interest and conversation. By August 7th, hope was abandoned, and Captain Orne had returned to the Wavecrest Inn to wind up his business affairs at Martin's Beach and confer with certain of the scientific men who remained there. The horror came on August 8th. It was in the twilight when gray seabirds hovered low near the shore and a rising moon began to make a glittering path across the waters. The scene is important to remember, for every impression counts. On the beach were several strollers and a few late bathers, stragglers from the distant cottage colony that rose modestly on a green hill to the north, or from the adjacent cliff-perched inn whose imposing towers proclaimed its allegiance to wealth and grandeur. Well within viewing distance was another set of spectators, the loungers on the inn's lantern-lighted veranda, who appeared to be enjoying the dance music from the sumptuous ballroom inside. These spectators, who included Captain Orne and his group of scientific confreres, joined the beach group before the horror progressed far, as did many more from the inn. Certainly there was no lack of witnesses, confused though their stories be with fear and doubt of what they saw. There is no exact record of the time the thing began, although a majority say that the fairly round moon was about a foot above the low-lying vapors of the horizon. They mention the moon because what they saw seemed subtly connected with it, a sort of stealthy, deliberate, menacing ripple which rolled in from the far skyline along the shimmering lane of reflected moonbeams, yet which seemed to subside before it reached the shore. Many did not notice this ripple until reminded by later events, but it seems to have been very marked, differing in height and motion from the normal waves around it. Some called it cunning and calculating. And as it died away craftily by the black reefs afar out, there suddenly came belching up out of the glitter-streaked brine a cry of death, a scream of anguish and despair that moved pity even while it mocked it. First to respond to the cry were the two lifeguards then on duty, sturdy fellows in white bathing attire, with their calling proclaimed in large red letters across their chests. Accustomed as they were to rescue work and to the screams of the drowning, they could find nothing familiar in the unearthly ululation, yet with a trained sense of duty, they ignored the strangeness, and proceeded to follow their usual course. Hastily seizing an air cushion, which with its attached coil of rope lay always at hand, one of them ran swiftly along the shore to the scene of the gathering crowd, whence, after whirling it about to gain momentum, he flung the hollow disc far out in the direction from which the sound had come. As the cushion disappeared in the waves, the crowd curiously awaited a sight of the hapless being whose distress had been so great, eager to see the rescue made by the massive rope. But that rescue was soon acknowledged to be no swift and easy matter, for pull as they might on the rope, the two muscular guards could not move the object at the other end. Instead, they found that object pulling with equal or even greater force in the very opposite direction, till in a few seconds they were dragged off their feet and into the water by the strange power which had seized on the proffered life preserver. One of them, recovering himself, called immediately for help from the crowd on the shore, to whom he flung the remaining coil of rope, and in a moment the guards were seconded by all the hardier men, among whom Captain Orne was foremost. More than a dozen strong hands were now tugging desperately at the stout line, yet wholly without avail. Hard as they tugged, the strange force at the other end tugged harder, and since neither side relaxed for an instant, the rope became rigid as steel with the enormous strain. The struggling participants, as well as the spectators, were by this time consumed with curiosity as to the nature of the force in the sea. The idea of a drowning man had long been dismissed, and hints of whales, submarines, monsters, and demons now passed freely around. Where humanity had first led the rescuers, wonder kept them at their task, and they hauled with a grim determination to uncover the mystery. It being decided at last that a whale must have swallowed the air cushion, Captain Orne, as a natural leader, shouted to those on shore that a boat must be obtained in order to approach, harpoon, and land the unseen leviathan. Several men at once prepared to scatter in quest of a suitable craft, while others came to supplant the captain at the straining rope, since his place was logically with whatever boat party might be formed. His own idea of the situation was very broad and by no means limited to whales, since he had to do with a monster so much stranger. He wondered what might be the acts and manifestations of an adult of the species of which the 50-foot creature had been the merest infant. And now there developed with appalling suddenness the crucial fact which changed the entire scene from one of wonder to one of horror, and dazed with fright the assembled band of toilers and onlookers. Captain Orne, turning to leave his post at the rope, found his hands held in their place with unaccountable strength, and in a moment he realized that he was unable to let go of the rope. His plight was instantly divined, and as each companion tested his own situation, the same condition was encountered. The fact could not be denied. Every struggler was irresistibly held in some mysterious bondage to the hempen line, which was slowly, hideously, and relentlessly pulling them out to sea. Speechless horror ensued, a horror in which the spectators were petrified to utter inaction and mental chaos. Their complete demoralization is reflected in the conflicting accounts they give, and the sheepish excuses they offer for their seemingly callous inertia. I was one of them, and no. Even the strugglers, after a few frantic screams and futile groans, succumbed to the paralyzing influence and kept silent and fatalistic in the face of unknown powers. There they stood in the pallid moonlight, blindly pulling against a spectral doom and swaying monotonously backward and forward as the water rose first to their knees, then to their hips. The moon went partly under a cloud, and in the half-light the line of swaying men resembled some sinister and gigantic centipede, writhing in the clutch of a terrible creeping death. Harder and harder grew the rope, as the tug in both directions increased, and the strands swelled with the undisturbed soaking of the rising waves. Slowly the tide advanced, till the sands so lately peopled by laughing children and whispering lovers were now swallowed by the inexorable flow. The herd of panic-stricken watchers surged blindly backward as the water crept above their feet, while the frightful line of strugglers swayed hideously on, half-submerged, and now at a substantial distance from their audience. Silence was complete. The crowd, having gained a huddling place beyond reach of the tide, stared in mute fascination, without offering a word of advice or encouragement, or attempting any kind of assistance. There was in the air a nightmare fear of impending evils, such as the world had never before known. Minutes seemed lengthened into hours, and still that human snake of swaying torsos was seen above the fast-rising tide. Rhythmically, it undulated, slowly, horribly, with the seal of doom upon it. Thicker clouds now passed over the ascending moon, and the glittering path on the waters faded nearly out. Very dimly writhed the serpentine line of nodding heads, with now and then the livid face of a backward-glancing victim gleaming pale in the darkness. Faster and faster gathered the clouds, till at length their angry rifts shot down sharp tongues of febrile flame. Thunders rolled, softly at first, yet soon increasing to a deafening, maddening intensity. Then came a culminating crash, a shock whose reverberations seemed to shake land and sea alike, and on its heels a cloudburst whose drenching violence overpowered the darkened world, as if the heavens themselves had opened to pour forth a vindictive torrent. The spectators, instinctively acting despite the absence of conscious and coherent thought, now retreated up the cliff steps to the hotel veranda. Rumors had reached the guests inside, so that the refugees found a state of terror nearly equal to their own. I think a few frightened words were uttered, but cannot be sure. Some who were staying at the inn retired in terror to their rooms, while others remained to watch the fast-sinking victims as the line of bobbing heads showed above the mounting waves and the fitful lightning flashes. I recall thinking of those heads and the bulging eyes they must contain, eyes that might well reflect all the fright, panic, and delirium of a malignant universe, all the sorrow, sin, and misery, blasted hopes and unfulfilled desires, fear, loathing, and anguish of the ages since time's beginning, eyes alight with all the soul-racking pain of eternally blazing infernos. And as I gazed out beyond the heads, my fancy conjured up still another eye, a single eye, equally alight, yet with a purpose so revolting to my brain that the vision soon passed. Held in the clutches of an unknown vice, the line of the damned dragged on, their silent screams and unuttered prayers known only to the demons of the black waves and the night wind. There now burst from the infuriate sky such a mad cataclysm of satanic sound that even the former crash seemed dwarfed. Amidst a blinding glare of descending fire, the voice of heaven resounded with the blasphemies of hell, and the mingled agony of all the lost reverberated in one apocalyptic, planet-rending peal of cyclopean din. It was the end of the storm, for with uncanny suddenness the rain ceased, and the moon once more cast her pallid beams on a strangely quieted sea. There was no line of bobbing heads now. The waters were calm and deserted, and broken only by the fading ripples of what seemed to be a whirlpool far out in the path of moonlight whence the strange cry had first come. But as I looked along that treacherous lane of silvery sheen, with fancy fevered and senses overwrought, there trickled upon my ears from some abysmal sunken waste the faint and sinister echoes of a laugh. Darlene pricked her finger with the needle and winced, immediately stuck the finger in her mouth, and tasted blood. "For Pete's sake, Misty, stand still." "Stop fussing over the girl, Darlene," said her husband Warren from across the room. "Honestly, you'll give her a case of hives." Darlene didn't give him the satisfaction of a glance. "You stay out of this. You might not care if our daughter goes to the cotillion looking like something a hound dragged in, but I do." "Mother," Misty sighed from atop the ottoman. "And you hush, too." She tugged on the sash she'd been altering, blowing a wisp of sweaty hair off her forehead. "Lord, Misty, you must have gained 10 pounds since we bought this dress. What have you been eating?" "Food, Mother." Misty shifted her weight to the other foot. "Can I please go now?" "Not until I finish this." Darlene pulled the sash up, widening the folds, pinning it back near the zipper. She reached for the sewing kit down by her foot. It was hot in the room, despite the air conditioning. The giant picture windows displayed a scene of visibly wavering humidity, where even the palm trees stood motionless, their fronds drooping and listless. Gripping the needle between her teeth, Darlene poked a strand of silky lavender thread through the eye, then grimly set to work on the sash. She wouldn't kid herself. She knew moving the sash wasn't going to completely camouflage the little roll of fat Misty had sprouted in the past 3 weeks. She glanced up at the mirror opposite. No, not perfect, but better than before, when the pale purple satin was stretched so taut that the dent of the girl's belly button showed. Even with Misty fidgeting and scratching at herself, Darlene managed to get the sash sewn on flawlessly. No one would be able to tell how the original dress had looked, and Darlene felt a tiny surge of pride at the thought. "There," she said. Now run along and take it off before you get it all sweaty. Finally, Misty leaped down from the ottoman, her mouse-brown hair sticking to her bare shoulders. She stomped into the adjoining bathroom, and Darlene heard sounds of rustling taffeta and muffled cursing. "You shouldn't be so hard on her, sugar." Warren was smoking a cigar, one leg crossed over the other. He was gazing out the window, his bald head sheened with perspiration. Darlene's anger bubbled up from her stomach and into the space behind her lips, but she let nothing escape. She simply glared at him, her mouth a tight line. Misty emerged from the bathroom, intruding on her parents' heavy silence. She was now clad in a faded pair of jeans with holes at the knees and a baggy gray t-shirt that had bleach spots across the breasts. "Daddy's right, you know," she said, grabbing a comb off her mother's dresser and yanking it through her hair. "I just want you to be the prettiest girl there," Darlene said, trying to keep the edge out of her voice, figuring she'd get further by flattering rather than nagging. "The Raiden boys are going to be there, you know. Maybe you'll catch the eye of one of them." "Mother," Misty rolled her eyes. "What century is this, for Christ's sake? Don't swear. And all I want is for you to be taken care of, darling. You're getting to the age when you should be thinking about getting married, and the Raiden boys are very good people. Who says I have to marry anybody?" Darlene's honeyed tones finally succumbed to the vinegar. "I say, no daughter of mine's going to end up an old maid." "Jesus, mother. Daddy, listen to her." Misty crossed her arms and scowled. "She just means the best for you, kitten," Warren said, puffing on his cigar. He smiled at his daughter, affectionately, if a little distantly. "Run along now." Misty blew him a kiss and flounced out of the room, glancing once over her broad shoulder and making a face at her mother. When she had gone, Darlene gave a harsh sigh. "Warren, you could be a bit more supportive." She began gathering up her sewing things, throwing them back in their box with far more force than was necessary. "I mean, look at the girl. She's getting fat, her face is starting to break out, she hasn't washed her hair in I don't know how long. She can't go to the cotillion like that, she'll be the laughingstock. I won't be able to show my face." "That's all you're really worried about, isn't it?" Warren's voice was very calm. He watched his cigar smoke swirling lazily toward the ceiling. "Showing your face." "Don't start with me, Warren T. Youngsblood III. You know damn well how Misty reflects on you as well as on me. You could at least pretend to care a little bit for your daughter's sake." "Misty's fine the way she is, sugar." He stubbed out his cigar in the ashtray next to his chair, then got to his feet with a grunt, clearly signaling that he was finished with the conversation. "Warren, don't you walk out on this." But he already was, waving his hand as if to dismiss her, his leather slippers whispering on the carpet. He didn't slam the door, but to Darlene it sounded as though he had. She stood in the middle of the room for a long moment, her teeth clenching and unclenching, without her being completely aware of it. The air conditioning hummed overhead, a lulling sound. Darlene went to the windows and stared out at the withering heat, feeling abandoned and put upon. Dusk was beginning to fall, and lights across the water were winking on like fireflies coming out to swarm. "Damn him," she thought. "Mr. Warren T. Big Shot Lawyer Youngsblood the Bloody Third." Misty most certainly wasn't fine the way she was, no matter what Big Shot Youngsblood had to say on the matter. And while he may have been content to let Misty be a fat, pimply slob who would never get a man, Darlene had other plans. Let Warren sit on his widening ass and smoke his cigars, she thought, balling her fists and scrutinizing her reflection in the darkening window. Misty needed fixing fast, and Darlene aimed to do something about it. It had been just before dawn when she'd set out. She hadn't told Warren where she was going, but she rarely did, and he never asked. Misty was staying over at a friend's house. It was now nearing 8:30, and the temperature was already hovering near 90. The air conditioning in the car was going full blast, but even so, the heat pressed down. Sunlight battered in through the windows, making Darlene feel like an egg in a microwave. She hadn't eaten any breakfast, though she'd pulled in at a rest stop for coffee a few miles back. The warm liquid now sloshed in her stomach, seemingly eating the lining away. At last, the exit for Garson loomed ahead, and she flipped on her blinker, coasting off the main highway with its late rush hour traffic. Thick knots of cypress trees began to close in as soon as she had cleared the ramp and merged onto the sun-baked two-lane that led to Garson. And then it was another 10 miles of nothing, the trees pressing in as though jostling for a look, clogging the air in her lungs. Finally, she passed the dispirited gas station that marked the Garson city limit. She cruised past it, noting its dust-caked windows, and the cigarette signs with ghosts of prices on them, pockmarked by bullet holes. Nothing ever changed here, she thought, as she drove into the town proper, steering carefully on the only paved street. This was the town where she'd been born, the town where she had walked barefoot to a clapboard schoolhouse, taking care not to stumble into the muddy swamps that edged the houses on three sides. This was a town where toothless old men drove hogs from their pitiful farms on market days, slapping the animals' flanks with willow switches, making them squeal so loud that they could be heard in every house in the village. It was a place where no one bothered to make fun of the kids with the ragged secondhand clothing or the facial deformities, because all the kids had one or the other, and sometimes both. Darlene passed the dirt road where her old house had stood, but she resisted turning down it. The house itself was no longer there anyway. It had been demolished in Hurricane Ivan, along with half the town. Her parents were gone too, claimed by alcoholism in her father's case, and a 12-gauge shotgun in her mother's. Darlene remembered them both, their faces briefly emerging from the tar pit of her distant memory. But she felt nothing at all. They might as well have been strangers. The town looked nearly deserted. Naturally, most of the residents would be indoors on such a scorching day. She noticed a few graying box fans propped up in screened windows, blades turning languidly, pushing the hot air around the interiors. As she passed the general store, she saw two very old men and one young one sitting on the wooden porch, rocking back and forth in their chairs, smoking pipes and watching her car go by through slitted, milky eyes. She only passed one other vehicle, a pickup truck that had probably once been red, before the sun and mud had taken its toll. The truck bed was packed with hay, and atop the piles rode a few bedraggled goats that stared dumbly out at the scrolling landscape. Once the tattered town center was behind her, Darlene kept driving, until the tiny concrete block houses and improvised wooden shacks became farther and farther apart before disappearing altogether. When the cypress trees closed in again, she drove some more. It was funny how she still remembered her way, even after all these years. It was almost as though the memory was imprinted, instinctual. There was no sound at all except for the roar of the air conditioning and the lazy buzz of the cicadas outside. Another mile and the road began to disintegrate, its faded asphalt gouged out in enormous pits that were brimming with stinking brown water. She vividly recalled the first time she had come out here. She'd been 16 and had ridden her bike. She'd had to steer through the minefield of potholes, had faltered once and sprawled headlong into one of the puddles. Her mother had been furious when she'd got home, shrieking over the state of her clothes, grilling her about where she'd been to get so filthy. Darlene had stood resolute under her mother's tirade, smiling secretly, inwardly. It wasn't long afterwards that the blare of the shotgun had silenced the woman's shrieking forever. Darlene carefully maneuvered the car off the road, parking it on what passed for a shoulder, feeling the tires sinking a few inches into the mud. It would be useless to drive any farther, she knew, for the road ahead was unpaved and usually washed out with the summer rains. But the place she was going was only a short walk from here. She fetched her first aid kit from the trunk and set out. The second time Darlene had come had been just past her 18th birthday. She almost laughed at the thought that Misty was now the same age she had been. But there had been no cotillion for Darlene, no fancy dress and expensive dyed shoes. No rich folks' sons in crisp tuxedos smiling at her with their pricey orthodontia. After her parents' death, she had simply stayed on in the little house by herself, dropping out of high school and taking a full-time job at the feed store to support herself. She'd had boyfriends, mostly local boys, big strapping things who always seemed to have teeth in the process of rotting down to nubs, who never seemed to have much going on under the rafters. Despite that, Darlene had genuinely liked some of them, and even let some of them touch her. Just over the panties, though, she was no slut. But even back then, she knew she was destined for something better. The second time she had come out here, she had driven an old car that she had paid for with her own money. It had more rust than paint and had a muffler that scraped gaily against the road, throwing sparks in all directions. But it was hers. She had walked through the woods in her knockoff designer jeans and her gold-toned hoop earrings, feeling like she owned the place. And just as cheeky as you please, she had stepped right up and asked for a miracle, a knight in shining armor to take her away from this place forever. Darlene couldn't help smiling darkly to herself as she picked her way through the moss-strewn undergrowth. Warren wasn't exactly a knight, but he was rich and relatively educated, and their meeting had seemed the stuff of fantasy. His car had broken down not far from Garson, and he'd hiked into town to use the telephone at the feed store where she worked. Yesterday's fury at Warren had softened a little, and she thought of him now with a touch more charitableness. Yes, he was stubborn and uninterested most of the time, and he drank too much and was far too flirtatious for his own good, but he had certainly done what she had wished for, and had shown her a way of life that she had never dared to imagine for herself. For that, she had to admit she was grateful to him. The heat made the way ahead of her seem hazy and unreal. The mist rose off the stagnant ponds and made the tree trunks look like black paint slashes against the whiteness. The smell was just as she remembered, green and thick and rotten, but with a seductive, musky quality that tickled the back of her throat. Something splashed just off to her left, and she jumped, but then a bird chattered amiably and dived past her into the trees, and her heart slowed again. The tree cover grew denser and denser overhead, and before long it almost seemed as though dusk had arrived several hours early. Her feet ached in their impractical gold skimmers, and her white blouse and slacks were so saturated with sweat that they were practically transparent. Her dark bangs clung to her powdered forehead. It occurred to her that the cabin might be gone, that the storm might have swept it away. Her brow furrowed, and she squinted into the verdant dimness. At first, she could see nothing but shifting shadows, but after a moment, something shimmered into existence, like a mirage in the desert. It was still here. The cabin looked almost exactly as she remembered, other than being slightly more weathered, the boards more riddled with termite tunnels. Everyone in Garson had called it a cabin, but that was a misnomer. There were only four rough walls that hung together in some semblance of structure. The little shack had no bottom, the slats and logs making up the house barely propped up by the mud and swamp water beneath. No one had ever ventured inside, but Darlene had sometimes pictured it in her mind's eye, the windowless walls crawling with slugs and blackflies, the sucking gurgles of the swamp like liquid breaths in the steamy, confined space. She suddenly felt very cold, despite the midday sun filtering through the branches. Darlene moved toward the cabin, glancing left and right, her ears poised to pick up the slightest sound. She noticed that silence had fallen over the woods, and she grew colder still, remembering those other two times she had come. The birds and insects had all ceased their trilling, and even the breeze seemed to have stilled, rendering all the leaves as motionless as marble. The only noise was the gentle lapping of the swamp upon the mud bank, a soft, organic sound that soon grew as loud as an ocean in her ears. About 100 yards in front of the cabin, almost concealed by the undergrowth, was a flat gray stone, roughly 4 feet across. Darlene was looking for it, and so didn't stumble when its edge suddenly appeared from the carpet of leaves and moss. She knelt down, feeling her blouse sticking to her back and armpits, and brushed the worst of the growth off the stone. Its surface was smooth and worn, with white gouges scattered like strange cuneiform letters. Dark stains were ground into most of the gashes, but Darlene tried not to look too closely. Looking around again, her skin crawling with the sensation of being watched, Darlene reached into the pocket of her slacks and drew out the small Swiss Army knife she'd taken from the kitchen drawer that morning. Some of the implements were mottled and rusty, but the knife blade looked passably sharp. With its tip, she tapped her chin, thinking. She'd have to cut something that wouldn't be noticed or that could be explained away fairly easily. The first time she'd come, she'd given the end of her left little finger. The second time, it had been a small chunk of her earlobe. No one but Warren had ever noticed either injury, and when she'd told him she'd done them in her high school shop class, he hadn't batted an eye. At last, Darlene slipped off one of her gold shoes. Teetering, she placed one foot up on the gray stone, planting the still-shod foot in the mushy undergrowth for balance. The cold that had seized her earlier was gone, and the breathless heat was back. As she leaned over her knee, knife in hand, her sweat spattered the rock with thick, fat droplets. The blade was poised over her toe, and she made herself breathe slowly, trying to calm the racing of her heart. Sweat dripped into her eyes, and she wiped it away with a trembling hand, feeling her mascara beginning to run. The woods around her grew quieter, as if waiting. Even the sound of the swamp water was no longer audible. Gripping the knife handle in her slick palm, Darlene gritted her teeth and sliced, whimpering but otherwise keeping the pain inside. She had to cut 4 times to completely sever the end of the little toe. It bled far more than she expected, and as she stared down at the widening puddle on the rock, her vision swam and she had to fight to keep her balance. The tiny pink fragment of flesh floated in a sea of red, like a nipple on a painted breast. Darlene felt nausea accompanying the faintness, but she shoved both away, grasping tightly at the knife handle as though it was her only lifeline. After a few moments, she had gathered herself, and she slid her bleeding foot from the rock, letting it settle into the cool, muddy leaves. The pain immediately subsided, though she could still feel the blood pumping freely in time with her hammering heartbeat. She dug her toes in deeper, stanching the flow, then pulled it out, quickly opening her first aid kit and washing the wound, wrapping it thickly in gauze, watching as the crimson bloomed onto the white fabric. Now, before the blood on the rock had dried, Darlene crouched down and placed her hands alongside her offering of flesh. She closed her eyes, feeling the heat in the forest around her like a living presence, huge and wild and not necessarily friendly. It was listening, she knew, waiting. Her eyes still closed, she told it silently what she wanted. When her litany was over, she opened her eyes very slowly, watching the dark greenery coming into focus around her. The air seemed lighter now, and the sound of the water had returned, heaving and sucking at the banks. She felt as though she had awakened from a dream, disoriented but somehow reborn. When the birds and insects resumed their chorus, Darlene stood and slid her dirty foot back into her gold shoe, carefully, so as not to dislodge the bandage. She gazed once more at the little cabin before her, which seemed to have subtly shifted. "Thank you, Mr. Scales," she murmured, then turned and limped out of the clearing, trying to ignore the enormous rolling splash that followed her pronouncement. The girl was radiant, her glossy hair falling in perfect dark ringlets around her heart-shaped face, her figure tiny and pert in its lavender satin sheath, her skin even and creamy and glowing. All traces of the fat roll and the pimples she'd displayed earlier in the week had miraculously vanished. Darlene felt her eyes filling with tears, but before they could spill over, she glanced around the room, making sure that everyone assembled kept their gazes fixed on her beautiful baby and on no one else. And yes, she saw, everyone was staring, expressions rapturous. Even the Raiden boys, Kyle and Justin, resplendent in their matching white tuxedos, were standing by the buffet table with their mouths hanging open. Darlene smiled, the elixir of triumph surging through her veins. Mr. Scales always came through. When Misty alighted from the staircase and relinquished her father's arm, she was practically trampled by the mobs of boys coming toward her, their hands outstretched, begging for the first dance. Darlene took another surreptitious look around and noticed all of the other girls in the room, lovely in their own right, of course, but no match for Misty, not tonight, staring daggers at her daughter, their tanned arms folded tightly across their breasts. She smirked. At last, the crowd around Misty dispersed. She had chosen her dance partner. It wasn't Kyle or Justin, Darlene saw, but an even more handsome boy, who she recognized as the only son of Dr. Avery Thomas, a prominent heart surgeon in town. Darlene silently applauded her daughter's excellent selection, then watched with amusement as the rejected boys began dancing with the other girls, the second choices. The boys were clearly disappointed and looked over their partner's shoulders at Misty whenever they thought they could get away with it. The songs changed and there was another mini melee. When it all shook down, Misty was dancing with the older Raiden boy, Kyle. She was smiling brightly at him and batting her eyelashes. Her golden, flawless skin rippled like silk under the muted light from the chandeliers. Warren sidled up to Darlene and slipped an arm around her waist. "See, sugar, there was absolutely nothing to worry about." He sounded as though he might have already downed a champagne or three, but Darlene just kissed his cheek. She didn't want anything to spoil her mood tonight. An hour passed in a mere moment, and Darlene had a pleasant champagne buzz going herself when there was a break in the music. Darlene had lost track of Misty for a while, but now she spotted her, pulling away from her latest partner. This boy was handsome, but he looked older and a little hard. Darlene didn't recognize him. Misty drifted toward her mother, smiling like an angel. Darlene held her hands out and swept her daughter into her embrace. "Are you having a good time, darling?" "Yes, mother, it's the best night of my life." She looked almost unreal, her skin flushed with excitement and exertion, her dark eyes syrupy and deep. Her voice was breathy. "I just wanted to say that I'm sorry for being such a pain the other day. I feel really bad. You were right about everything." Darlene glanced sidelong at Warren, who stood a few feet away, not even listening. She focused her attention back on her daughter. "I always want what's best for you, Misty," she said, snagging another champagne when the waiter slithered by with the tray. She gestured with the glass toward the dance floor, where the unfamiliar boy was waiting, his hands in the pockets of his trousers, his chin tilted back ever so slightly, giving him an air of arrogance. He was obviously staring at Misty and obviously not caring who noticed him doing it. "Who's the mystery man you've been dancing with?" Misty's eyes sparkled and she leaned close to her mother conspiratorially. "His name's Alec. Isn't he adorable?" Darlene squinted through the thickets of shimmering satin and taffeta. Adorable wasn't exactly a word that she would have used to describe Alec. He was indeed a good-looking man, tall and broad, with a definite aura of physical strength, almost of menace. His hair was dark, but patterned with lighter streaks at odd intervals, like a tortoiseshell. His face was wide, as was his mouth, giving the illusion that he wore a permanent sardonic grin. Darlene couldn't tell what color his eyes were from this distance, but they looked strange, pale and intense. Her brow furrowed. "Who are his parents?" Misty shrugged. "He said he was an orphan. But don't worry, he seems to have plenty of money." She glanced back and gave an almost imperceptible wave. Darlene squared her shoulders, meaning to ask how Misty could know the boy had money, but she decided to let it pass. "Well, don't monopolize the boy. How were Kyle and Justin? They're nice young men, I hear." "Yeah, they were nice." Misty's tone was dreamy, barely there, and she glanced backward again, her whole body seeming to pull toward Alec's tractor beam gaze. There was a crackle from the sound system, and then the music started up again, a slow song that had been all over the radio that summer, and Misty cocked her ear toward it like a bird hearing the call of its mate. "I'll talk to you later," she said, and drifted away, the lavender silk of her skirt rustling like a shared secret. "Misty!" But the girl was already gone, holding out her arms toward Alec, being swept into his large, slightly intimidating embrace. There was something almost feral in the way he held her, his big hands claw-like and possessive on the peach-glow expanse of her back. Darlene's stomach knotted, and she looked to Warren for support, but he had moved farther away and was draping himself drunkenly across the shoulders of Dr. Thomas's young, saucily blonde wife. Darlene seethed but made no motion to rein him in. She would let him have it later at home, when she wouldn't cause an embarrassing scene. Misty was the important issue at present. Darlene set her mostly drained glass on a table against the wall and threaded her way through the crowd, swaying a little on her feet but otherwise controlled. It was difficult to get a good look at Misty and Alec. They had moved to the middle of the dance floor, and Darlene could only catch glimpses of them through the shifting obstructions at the other couples. But she could see enough to discern that they were dancing far too close for propriety, their bodies pressed together as though striving to become one, their lips poised and shining and only inches apart. Every now and then, Alec would lean his large head close and whisper something in Misty's ear. She would look at him then with her twinkling eyes, her expression fervid and serious. Darlene bit her lip and tapped her foot on the parquet floor. With every minute that passed, she was liking the situation less and less. The slow song finally ended and the couples broke up, some wandering off to pair up with others, some retreating to the tables for refreshments. Darlene hoped she would spot Misty milling through the crowd, searching for a new partner, but she wasn't terribly surprised to see that she and Alec were walking languidly hand in hand toward the French doors at the far end of the ballroom, the ones that opened onto the patio. Darlene felt the last of the champagne buzz curdling into a livid sobriety as she watched them. She found she no longer cared what indiscretions Warren was perpetrating, and she did not look around for him to back her up. Her prime objective from this moment was to stop Misty wandering out onto the lonely patio with this handsome nobody who had so audaciously staked his claim. Darlene thought of the sight of his huge hands on Misty's silky, vulnerable back, and the memory drove her forward, adding fuel to the engine of her mounting rage. The couple was at the door now, and Alec swept it open in an ostentatious gesture of chivalry, standing aside to let Misty hover through the door atop her lavender finery. He followed then, very close behind her, and pulled the door shut, quietly but definitively. Darlene's pace quickened, her fury now all-consuming. She pushed through the swirling crowds, everything moving in slow motion around her through the fairy lights and laughter. The door ahead of her loomed huge and solitary, blocking out all else in her vision. It seemed to take an eternity to reach it, as though it was a door in a dream. Finally, she clasped the latch. She didn't open the door, not right away. First, she stood very still, her ear pressed against the frosted glass. For a few moments, she heard nothing more than the lapping of the lake against the wooden deck supports. But then she thought she could make out other sounds, secretive giggles and intimate murmuring. Her blood boiled. Silently, she turned her hand on the door latch, restraining the urge to throw the door wide and confront the couple. She pushed at the glass, opening it just a crack. Peering through, she could just see them on the far end of the patio, their backs partially facing her. They were standing very close, closer than they had when they were dancing, and Darlin's temper flared up another few notches. Alec had his face nuzzled into Misty's neck, looking like a vampire draining blood from the jugular, and Misty, for her part, seemed to be enjoying the sensation immensely, her head thrown back, her eyes closed, her back wantonly arched. Darlin, noting their preoccupation, risked opening the door a little further, spilling muted yellow light onto the deck in a long, thin parallelogram. Now Misty had begun to push her hips up into Alec's body, gyrating a little, and her hands searched out his tortoiseshell hair, clasping through the strands as though seeking a handhold for her desperate need. Alec's motions at her neck grew more heated, and his fingers began inching their way down from her shoulders toward her high, round breasts, wrapped in their shiny covering of pale violet satin. Darlin, unable to stand anymore, flung the door wide. Several things happened at once. Misty's hand seemed to come away from Alec's head, but with the hair still attached. Darlin squinted hard in the dimness, thinking she might still be drunk after all, unsure of what she was seeing. Before Misty had quite realized what had happened, Alec had reared back, and the twinkling lights from the windows shone down upon a hideous deformity, a head that appeared coarse, misshapen, discolored. Darlin gasped, and at the small sound, Alec whipped his face toward her. His eyes were like no human eyes she had ever seen. Inside, in the bewitching light from the chandeliers, perhaps no one had noticed, but here in the darkness, the filmy, glowing eyes of a nocturnal creature were unmistakable. Yellow and reptilian, with deep black slits for pupils, they narrowed as they watched Darlin. Misty, too frightened to move, shivered against the railing of the patio, wiping her hands obsessively on her skirt as though to rid herself of a skin-borne plague. She had dropped the wig at her feet, and it lay there, the breeze ruffling through it almost playfully. Alec still held her, tightly, and though she struggled some against his grip, it was clear that her strength was no match for his. "Don't hurt her." Darlin risked two steps out onto the patio, then pushed the door closed behind her, immediately muffling the sounds of gaiety from inside. She wanted help, needed it, but she didn't like the thought of what the creature might do to Misty if everyone at the party came rushing out to see what was going on. She held out her hands, a universal gesture of surrender. Alec simply stood and looked at her, his chest rising and falling in regular rhythm. Darlin noticed that the scaly skin upon his head extended down his neck and disappeared into the collar of his tuxedo shirt. The image of what he might look like under his clothes made her shudder. "Mother!" Misty was imploring, pleading with her eyes. Darlin realized that her daughter still looked unnaturally beautiful, even in her distress. The knot in her stomach tightened. "Mr. Scales." As soon as she said the name, the air surrounding them seemed to change, become cold and hushed, a pocket of isolation. Darlin had noticed Misty's eyes widen, silently questioning how her mother knew the identity of this creature that held her. But Darlin kept her gaze fixed on Alec. "What more do you want from me?" she asked, taking a few more steps forward. "What can I give you to release her?" Alec tilted his head, the gesture of a wary predator. His lips parted, frog-like, but no sound emerged. In Darlin's head, though, a voice rattled in a hollow croak, the voice of the swamps in the town where she'd been born.
"There is nothing,"
the voice said, as Alec stood there with his crocodilian mouth open and smiling its sardonic smile.
"Three favors I have granted you, woman. The first two times I took what you gave, I did what you asked, even though sometimes you asked for evil things. But you are too greedy. This time I did what you asked, but the offering you left was not enough. I came to take more."
Darlin felt as though she was a million miles away from anywhere, frozen in time, the secret green smell of her childhood forming a dimension all its own. Misty had started to cry, a pitiful keening into the wind. "Take me instead, then." Darlin didn't know she was going to speak the words until she said them, but once they were out, she knew that this was the way things were supposed to go. He seemed to be considering, his golden eyes glittering in the darkness.
"Perhaps something can be arranged,"
he croaked silently. With his free hand, which looked more like a claw now than ever, he gestured to Darlin to come toward him. "Let Misty come to me first," she said, not moving. Mr. Scales shook his head.
Come here, or I will pull her down in the water with me, take her back to the swamps.
He grinned wider with his horrible mouth.
She will make a lovely wife for a lonely old man like me.
Darlin's mind grew crowded with images of her beautiful baby pressed into the mud under the belly of this nightmare creature. She moved toward him quickly, holding her hands out like a lifeline. Misty. Misty reached out for her mother, her face contorted with anguish and confusion, but still as angelic as ever. Help me, she said. Darlin had just touched her daughter's fingers when she felt Mr. Scales' powerful arm encircling her waist. She screamed, but the sound was pitiful, carried away by the strange cold breeze.
Don't fight, woman,
the voice croaked in her head.
Your end will be quick.
No, Darlin struggled hard, feeling the creature's sandpaper skin against her cheek and neck. She threw her head back, seeing the lights from inside, the shadowed forms moving behind the French doors. Warren was there, he must be missing them by now. Surely he would come out soon to see where they had gone.
No one will come for you,
Mr. Scales whispered into her brain, as though he was reading her thoughts.
Your daughter is blameless, so she will be spared, to live with me forever in my beautiful swamp. But you...
He made a strange bellowing sound, a sound of disgust.
No one knew what you wished about your parents, but I knew.
Darlin began hitting him in the chest with her fists, but it felt like he was wearing armor. Why did you grant my wish then? She shrieked. Why?
You ask, I do,
he croaked simply.
It is my curse.
With that, the muscles in his arms tightened until Darlin felt trapped by bands of iron. She tried to scream again, but she could get no air. Her lungs seemed filled with swamp water, green and black and muddy. Her feet left the floor of the deck and she was falling, falling backwards. Then there was a splash, and it was cold, so very cold. Misty screamed and beat her arms against the water, but then even that sound became muted as Darlin was dragged under the water of the lake that led to the swamps where she had been born. The water cradled her like a lover, and Mr. Scales wrapped his powerful arms around her body, and the world went silent and green, and then it went black.